Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. With me tonight is Tony Godling from Bristol, England. Welcome back, Tony.
Hi, George.
Okay, man, there's a lot going on. We had the shooting here. I guess you followed that some. And in England, there's no parliament yet, is there? Do we know?
Well, there is a parliament just, but we've had a what they call a hung parliament, which means that there's no overall majority. So politically, Theresa May should be history, right? So she has called a general election on the basis which she didn't need to do, 3 years ahead of time, right?
Right.
I mean, you have to laugh because it's so ridiculous that anybody could have any confidence in her whatsoever. She should really be, at this stage, a backbencher. I mean, she clearly has got absolutely no ability to lead anything because she's led the country into this general election. She's led the Tory party into an embarrassing defeat. So they've lost their majority in the House of Commons. That means they can't pass legislation at all without the support of the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, some of whom are ex-paramilitaries on the loyalist side, you know, the anti-republican, anti-Catholic side, and the Orange Order dominates the DUP. Also worth mentioning it that the Conservative Party is also known as the Conservative and Unionist Party. Now that is a reference to the DUP, effectively, saying that it's one party. But this has been, it's been pretended, I think, for a long time that they're two separate parties. Actually, they're very close. I think it's pretty clear that the DUP is a Masonic party. I mean,
it is. Oh, man.
All but name. Well, you have a look at the Orange, basically all of the people who are running that party are Orange Order supporters. They're also supporters of the Ian Paisley Church that he created called the Free Presbyterian Church.
Right.
And they're very religious, but then they're also quite puritanical. So they're not, shall we say, lovey-dovey, huggy religious or happy-clappy at all. They're very sort of austere, a bit morose, kind of dour, if you want. But anyway, so they have also, DUP have come straight from their own scandal, which has closed down the Stormont Parliament in Northern Ireland. That happened last year, but it was because the Democratic Unionist Party had been, basically they'd taken £500 million of public money and they'd been giving it to their mates. So they'd been running this scheme for energy efficiency, but they'd been discriminating against Catholics. This is the sort of thing that's been going on for literally 400 years in Northern Ireland, possibly even more. And it was at the roots, the discrimination at the roots of the Northern Ireland troubles in the 1970s, 80s and 90s. So this is not looking good for an even-handed government in Northern Ireland to have these guys now holding the balance of power in Westminster.
Oh, my God, the Brits won't do that, will they?
Well, that is what's got to happen. I mean, Theresa May and the Conservative Party, their majority relies on these 10 MPs from Ireland. Well, look, George, it's not the first time that Irish MPs have held the balance of power at Westminster. And it doesn't give them total power, but it gives them a power much, much greater than the size of the party and the number of seats. So they've only got 10 seats in a 700, 600 MP parliament. But their power is much greater. Now, if you go back, I love this history stuff. I hope you don't mind me indulging myself with it. But if you go back to the 1800s, to the 19th century, the 1880s, there was a big dispute in Ireland with the Captain Boycott, if you remember. That's where the word comes from, boycotts going on.
Okay.
Of the rich Protestant landowners were being boycotted by all the population there because of things like the famines. Now, the famines were where the food just simply wasn't being distributed to Catholics in Catholic areas. And, of course, there was the potato blight as well helping. But, I mean, what they were effectively doing was using the potato blight as a way of channeling people onto migrant ships over to the good old USA.
Right. A lot of them came here because of the potato famine.
That's right. But the thing is that it was a kind of confected thing because the people were being starved. good food was being carted out of Ireland to England, whilst people who were actually in Ireland, they were watching it as they were starving, being carted past them. So it was a very sectarian thing. Queen Victoria was basically racist, you know. She was very anti the Catholics, as, of course, has been, you know, part of most of the Protestant world. And, you know, a lot of William Shakespeare's plays are based on this anti-Catholic bias. I mean, he was very pro-Catholic himself, and he was, you know, I don't know if he was actually a Catholic, but he was writing in days when it was a terrible thing to be a Catholic, and yet it was a kind of almost like sort of a bit like during the early days of the church with Jesus and his friends. You know, it was quite cool to be this part of this underground movement. And Shakespeare was, you know, whilst the Protestants were persecuting the Catholics. So, you know, that's effectively what was going on in Ireland too. So you've got this persecution and starvation and deliberate starving of millions of people in Ireland. And so that's what effectively this, the DUP is the modern kind of equivalent of these types of people. I'm not saying they're quite so drastic, but of course all this discrimination did well up in the 1970s because the way that that Northern Ireland was being managed by the Protestants to make sure that the Catholics had no good houses, they had no good jobs, they had no access to things like bank loans or whatever if they wanted to, you know, start a business. It was a very discriminatory place. In fact, they found it very, very difficult even to be allowed to vote. And that's what caused the, through the civil rights movement in the 1960s, really, you know, and it was the British Parachute Regiment shooting into unarmed demonstrators in the early 1970s, what they call Bloody Sunday, that sparked off the Troubles. And, you know, I'm not saying this is all going to, you know, be rekindling this, but it does mean that it's quite clear to the Catholics and the Republicans, the nationalist movement in Ireland, that the Protestants again are in the ascendant, and the DUP are in the ascendant. What does this actually mean for people? Well, a lot of people are questioning Sinn Féin, which is the political wing of what was the Republican movement, the Irish Republican Army. And Sinn Féin has got, I think it's now 6 MPs, but they never go to Westminster. So they're elected, but they never take up their seats. It'd be quite interesting to see if those Sinn Féin MPs were to take, because they've got every right to take up their seats, if they were to change their mind and just this time say, oh, we're going to take up our seats now. They have every legal right to do it. That would throw a real spanner in the works for Theresa May. But I mean, the main thing is, how is the Northern Ireland going to be able to govern itself again? And I just hope that they're able to reinstitute the Stormont Parliament. So there's a lot of sort of minutiae of Irish politics, which I hope, you know, I think important to explain that it's not really a religious dispute. It's much more a kind of incoming, a bit like Palestine, really. You've got an incoming community who use religion as a way to sort of beat their fellow man and to say, well, you know, actually you're a different lot to us, and you know, that isn't really what religion is about. It's about being kind and peaceful. It's not about invading people, taking their land, stealing their land and bullying them around. So, you know, they're two different communities. I mean, we even have things like in the places like Glasgow, Liverpool, you know, you've got the two football teams. You've got the Catholic football team and the Protestant football team. You know, usually one is green and the other one red, you know, whatever. But, you know, that is a bit of a divide. And I lived over in Northern Ireland for a while during the Troubles and saw it for myself, because I was reading bulletins on the BBC here in Britain and thinking to myself, I don't understand these words. You know, unionist, Catholic, loyalist, UVF, UFF, IRA, Republican, you know, who is doing what? Nationalist, who is doing what? And, you know, what are the divides? So effectively you've got a potential powder keg still in Northern Ireland, but you know, I'm just hoping that we'll see a bit of leadership from Jeremy Corbyn to show just how useless Theresa May is, because she is effectively a dead woman walking. She really is. I mean, because she's made such a mess of this, calling this general election for herself, for her party, for Brexit. And my big suspicion, George, I don't know what you think, is that the general election was actually confected by the super elite, because they don't want the what was the previous version of the Tory Party to have a hard Brexit and a complete split.
I think they're afraid of Brexit. They're afraid they're against that. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course Theresa May has gone along with this stupidly, like a zombie, and she's paid the price. But she's still the Prime Minister, which is unbelievable. I mean, she went along to just after the general election to see the Queen, but she went. She took her husband with her. Her husband is a multi-millionaire, billionaire. Some say he's a investment fund manager. Works with this company called Capital Group, who are based in Los Angeles, and I would imagine the Queen is actually much more interested in chatting with him than with Theresa May. So he wears the trousers, effectively, and he really is just telling Theresa May what to do, I think.
Oh, man, sort of behind the scenes, right?
Yeah, it's a bit like somebody like Henry Kissinger trying to nag Donald Trump.
Yeah, I tell you, boy. You know, they're getting serious about removing Trump now with the you know, obstruction of you know, justice charges.
Well, wasn't it, you know, I'm just thinking about that Jeff Sessions, when he was being accused of, basically treachery. It was so much like the McCarthyite witch hunt trials from the 1950s. I mean, I wasn't alive at the time, but you see recordings of these sessions. You know, were you ever a member of the Communist Party? Have you associated with the Communist? You know, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is exactly what we're getting right now. And, of course, it was Arthur Miller, wasn't it, who was, I think it was Marilyn Monroe's fella for a while. I don't know if they were married. Were they married?
Yeah, I think it was her boyfriend, yeah.
It was his play, The Crucible, which I think, you know, I don't know if they're still teaching it, but every school kid should study this play.
Yeah.
And actually, it's a brilliant, fun play to enact it out, because you have this, I saw Jeff Sessions with the devil. I've seen Jeff Sessions with the devil. It's this kind of, this disease mentality where there really isn't any evidence, strong evidence to suggest these things. But you've got a witch hunt going on. That's
well, you know, they don't even need much to impeach a president if they can get the votes in the House and Senate.
See? So, I mean, have these hearings of Jeff Sessions been taking place in Salem, Massachusetts?
Done what now?
Were the hearings taking place in Salem, Massachusetts?
Oh, yeah, the witch trial. Well, you know, he testified before Congress the other day and came off pretty well.
Yes, I think he did. And I don't know if it's going to wash this, but yeah, certainly there is an attempt to get Trump. It was really interesting to see, literally 3 days after the close of the Bilderberg conference, was the first serious move to impeach the president.
Terrence McAuliffe. Remember he was on Bilderberg meetup?
List? Yeah.
Well, he's the governor of Virginia. Now, he's slated for, he got the blessings to be elevated now. And he may be the next president of the United States in 2020.
Well, we shall see.
Yeah.
Certainly, the fact that he's appeared at Bilderberg suggests he might be. But, you know, I think we've got a frightening government now, because I don't know what you think, George, as an ex-military man, but it looks to me as if Trump has taken a back seat when it comes to foreign policy now. And he's letting basically Exxon run the show through Rex Tillerson, and he's really ceding policy to James Mattis, you know, Mad Dog Mattis, the butcher of Fallujah, over. And I noticed just the other day, even Human Rights Watch is criticizing them for these phosphorus bomb attacks last week in Iraq and in Syria. What the hell are they doing? This is, everybody knows this stuff is illegal under international law. These are war crimes. You don't use white phosphorus.
I saw that, yeah. They used it over there, yeah.
Certainly not in civilian areas where there's been very little coverage of it. This is the thing.
Well, the Israelis were using it in Gaza.
Well, you just imagine if the Russians were to be using it.
It would be
the main news for a week on the top of the headlines and the front pages. But because it's the US using it, and Mattis. But I wonder what you think, George, about you know, whether Trump has taken, as it looks like he has,
North Korea's dead. We're not going to attack. I don't know who made that change, but it's we pulled back our task forces already.
So well, I'll tell you what happened is that the South Korean, the new South Korean president, has told them to go home.
Well, they shipped that student, that poor student, back in a coma.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that isn't that crazy? I mean, they induced something, gave him something to induce a problem, you know, neurological problem, and then shipped him back on a plane. We flew him out of there, you know, but he's in a coma still.
But look, I mean, this is all interesting, but the Middle East is really where it's at in Israel policy. I mean, it seems to me most of our policy in the Middle East, that is Britain and America's policy, is framed around Israeli-U.S. interests. And I wonder what you make of the use of white phosphorus. Is that something you think is just Mattis deciding? Because, of course, he used it in Fallujah. I don't know if Trump even knows it's been used.
It shouldn't be used at all. You know, it's a prohibited.
Would Trump be signing that off, or is he just said to his generals, you get on with the war?
The problem with Trump is that he's an authoritarian personality type, and he defaults to these guys in uniform on stuff like that. And they're just they want to use what they've got available. Okay.
Well, that's quite feasible. You know, you've got. I think it was the Syrian ambassador who I interviewed last week. He's a former UK ambassador to Syria, a guy called Peter Ford, and he's very outspoken about what's happened over there. In fact, he had an attack on his life while he was the ambassador, where the Syrian police shot dead these various jihadis who'd come over from, they think, from Iraq to try and kill him in his ambassador's residence. And he was describing that pretty frightening episode. But he had every respect for the Syrian government. He said these guys, you know, they basically put their lives at risk to look after him. They did a really good job in you know, basically taking out this squad of jihadis with rocket-propelled grenades, kind of bazooka things, to try and blow him up in his residence, and they took him down. Basically, they took him out, you know. And but he's also one of the people. Sounds like you, like similar to what you're saying that when it comes to uniforms, Trump never said no to a man in a uniform.
Right. I've seen kids and Palestinian kids in the Gaza that got hit with that phosphorus stuff, and it burns right through them. It's terrible wounds.
Well, what it does is it actually feeds off human flesh, effectively. It goes into one side of the person, and it reacts with human flesh, and it actually becomes more hot and burning and dangerous, and then it kind of goes into the next person. I mean, it really is. It's evil stuff.
It's very evil.
It's like, yeah, it's weapon. A kind of a living hell, basically.
It is. It's an evil system, you know, explosive.
Yeah. I mean, I would also compare it to the use of white phosphorus in, I think it was 2004, by Mattis in Fallujah, as well as the use by the Brits too of depleted uranium over in Iraq.
We've
been using these countries as a total dumping ground and flaunting international law. And of course, it's talking of international law. It's exactly 50 years since the Six-Day War at the moment. That's just over, in fact. But that was one of the most important conflicts in history, because it really was even just a few years after the end of the Second World War. There's been some really good articles on it. I don't know if you've been checking them out, George, on the Six-Day War, but. It just to show, for example, that the whole thing, there was a great thing on The Intercept with one of their correspondents on, you know, Glenn Greenwald.
Well, the Israelis initiated the war. They attacked.
That's right.
And
the myth was supposed to be that Israel was under threat, blah, blah. Actually,
they said they were surrounded by the Arab forces and they just had to attack. That's the reason. But then they took out the Liberty. Remember, they almost sank the Liberty?
That's right. Well, wasn't it a sort of minor miracle that the Liberty didn't actually sink?
The guy that was on board there that survived, one of the survivors, I interviewed him years ago. You know what happened? He started crying on my program. he was so emotionally, you know what I mean, distraught about the Liberty. He lost his best friend. There was a bulkhead on one side where the torpedo hit. It took out his best friend, and he was on the other side and lived. And he had become an alcoholic, and he was a preacher at the time that I interviewed him, and he broke down and cried on my program. I mean, well, it's very emotional.
I think the reason people do that is because they're there risking their lives for their country, and their country doesn't give a damn about them.
That's right. I met a man, one of our ASA surveillance operators on the top of a mountain in Africa, okay, Asmara. And they were intercepting all the communications, and they had Hebrew linguists up there, English and everything. And they saw the whole thing unfold, and they were, you know, privy to the witnessing of the attack by the Israelis.
Yeah, I mean, the Six-Day War is a bit of a misnomer, isn't it?
Yeah.
This war is still going on. It's endured for 50 years. It was the biggest land grab. I mean, they something like trebled the size of the Israeli state, basically land grabbing. And you know
That's
what
it.
They're saying?
Yeah.
They say it's a holy land grab. That's what they
say.
Well,
you know, Miko Pelid, his father, General Pelid, was one of the heroes of the Six-Day War. And after the war he was consulting with Parliament in Israeli, and he withdrew his support for the government because he said that's what they were doing. They were pushing out the Palestinians and grabbing the land.
And the so-called hero general of the Israelis, Moshe Dayan, famously said, Israel should be like a mad dog, too dangerous to bother. And I'm afraid that is the U.S. Israeli, and to a similar extent,
well,
British.
Yeah, there have been people that have written about the Israeli lobby and their dominance of our politics, and they're absolutely right about that. AIPAC and all that are very dominant in the political dominance of our Congress. But they're all working together with our CIA and the Mossad. They're all working together, MI6, you know what I mean. They're all together on these things.
Yeah, but you see, there is a narrative, a growing narrative, that understands this. I mean, looking at, for example, Netanyahu's book from the 1980s, Terrorism, How the West Can Win. Right, so he's edited this book. In fact, he did a chapter of his own,
right?
Benjamin Netanyahu, saying that, well, you know, we've got these problems with these Arab terrorists, and this is how you beat them. Effectively, what they were saying was, let's institute this British, what was originally a British policy, which is the counter-gang policy. So what you do is you set up fake cells of these terrorists that you want to overwhelm. And those fake cells then go out carrying out the most appalling atrocities. And you use that to discredit the entire terrorist uprising, or wherever it happens to be, whether it's Kenya. The British were doing this with the Mau Mau in Kenya. And but what, of course, has happened since is that they're using this whole kind of terrorist meme in order to have a... Well, you see, they're not terrorists anymore, George. What they are is state-sponsored. So the terrorists...
Right.
The trouble is the terrorists are supposed to be these sort of free-acting...
It's just like the Gladio stuff, you know, just similar.
Yeah, freedom fighters, but they're not.
Yeah.
They are actually state-sponsored, and quite often when you're seeing a terrorist attack, what you're seeing is simply a covert action by the British military, the US military... you know, maybe the Germans, this kind of thing. I mean, we had this recently, this German Nazi cell uncovered that was planning an attack in unbelievable, it's that it's got so little coverage, in the Vienna airport in Austria. They were planning a terrorist attack. This is the German army, a Nazi cell within the German army, planning a terrorist attack in Vienna airport, and they'd already smuggled guns in. They'd already arranged for the German army officer, lieutenant, to be smuggled out after the attack, and his fingerprints to be left there to be blamed on because he'd already registered his fingerprints as a Syrian refugee's fingerprints, right?
Oh, man.
So the idea was they were going to leave a trail that was going to lead to it being done by a Syrian. So what they're not stupid. What they do is they make sure that the police, as they're investigating, have got a little trail. They lead them along that trail, and but always pointing towards usually a Syrian or someone that, but at the end of the day, with same as these attacks we've had in Britain, you know, both the London Bridge attack
a
couple of weeks ago and the Manchester attack, all of these attacks look very much, in fact the one with on Westminster Bridge as well back in March, are all people who are at the top of the MI5 watch list. They're people who have had dealings with MI6 at the top of the MI5 watch list. In other words, the MI5 should have 100% surveillance, and yet somehow they managed to get hire vans without MI5 noticing, leave them in the middle of the street overnight, annoy everybody, make a very big, obvious mess in their local area. They're being reported by the mosques to be banned from mosques. They're being reported to the anti-terrorist hotline, being reported to MI5 directly by people picking up the phone saying, this guy's a nutter, he may do an attack. And what happens? He does his attack. So effectively, MI5 is aiding and abetting, very much like the FBI in the US has been setting up these entrapment operations, where what they do is they give people explosives, they egg them on, they urge them to do an attack. And then, of course, though they might scratch their heads a bit and say, why are they doing this? And then all of a sudden they find the feds everywhere. They're maybe shot dead. They're so-called terrorists. But the whole point of all of this is really just to forward Israeli foreign policy in the Middle East.
Right.
And they this horrible... I mean, this is the thing that goes on. The Jewish fundamentalists, Israeli fundamentalists, Zionist fundamentalists, really, we should call them. They are the most dangerous of all, I think, because they've decided that there's going to be a holy war, that it might be called the Battle of Armageddon or something, but it's going to happen, and God has ordained it. And so any attempt at peace is futile. There's no point in talking peace, because this is inevitable, and it's been fatalistically decreed by God that they're going to have this massive war. And that's why they're not really working for peace. They might talk about it a bit, George, but I don't think there's any real attempt. And they want to just clear the Al-Aqsa Mosque off of the Third Temple site in Jerusalem, and of course that is going to ignite even more problems. But they hope, I think, to exploit that war. The arms companies do too. And the only trouble is, of course, you've got the Russians very much involved in Syria now. The Russians back again. It was the Soviet Union, but now...
What do you think is going to happen in Syria? Tony, what's going to happen there? It's really...
Well, it's difficult to know, isn't it? Because you've got US bases being set up there. The British Army are in there.
I know.
According to the Syrian...
It looks like it's going to be a long, drawn-out settlement. That's what I see.
Well, I don't know if the Russians have got the wherewithal to actually clear them out of Syria. I don't know. Maybe they've just decided that certain parts of Syria they're going to just give them up. I don't know. But certainly they're not going to give up Syria as a whole. They're not going to give up the Tarsus naval base. They're not going to give up the airfields, that sort of thing. So it seems to me that Syria, it's the road to Damascus, isn't it? Getting biblical.
Right, right. God, that's true.
That is where the whole regime change policy bashed its head up against a brick wall.
Yeah. It gets crazy, doesn't it, sometimes?
Well, the road to Damascus is where it happened.
Road to Damascus, yeah. Man, I tell you.
Okay, so, yeah, but also, I mean, yeah, I mean, we've got here in British politics, we've got, also had this terrible fire in London. I don't know if you've seen
Yes, I followed that 24-hour story.
Absolutely horrendous. And it's all caused really by the attempt to privatise. Okay, so this is originally built by local authorities with government money, these big housing blocks. Actually built very safe, but this particular block last year was refurbished by a bunch of cowboys. And no insult intended to US cowboys. Cowboys are people that just don't know what they're doing. We're talking about cowboy electricians, cowboy contractors who take a lot of money, make a lot of profit, and then walk away.
Oh, okay.
And in the electrical systems which were put into this building, there were power surges going on. And it's pretty clear that the fire started in flat 16 on the fourth floor, and it was a fridge next to a window in the guy's kitchen exploded.
Oh, man.
Okay, so his fridge exploded. The fire brigade turned up. The trouble was the fridge was by the window. It caught fire to the whole window, which is a kind of plastic window, and he obviously had to get out of his flat, but the fire brigade went into that flat. they put the fire out, by which time, though, the fridge fire had caught to the cladding on the outside of the building. Now, the cladding is not, for some reason, this is why I mean cowboys, right? The guys that had fitted this stuff, it was not fireproof. So it was a special sort of insulation designed to keep the flats nice and warm and save people's heating bills.
Right.
But the thing, it was flammable.
Oh, my gosh.
So as the flames came out of this guy's window and the fire brigade, as they're putting the fire out in his flat, so the fire was spreading up the side of the building.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's why we are where we are today. I mean, it's also an area of mass gentrification where they're trying to push the poor people out of these big blocks of flats. And it's raised the issue very high on the agenda in Britain now, as this whole business of people being pushed out. And there's a lot of very articulate local people from that area, Ladbroke Grove, Latimer Road. I mean, there it's a great part of London. You know, if you're ever in, they're really. I mean, it's where you get a lot of sort of pop stars and cheek by jowl with a lot of migrants. It's a brilliant little part of London, but they're trying to make it just for the rich, and so there will be attempts, I imagine, to smash all these tower blocks down and build luxury flats there. It's gentrification. So that's in the background of all of this.
Oh, man.
But then there's also the the aspects of the way the place was managed, because it was a tenant-managed place. Of course, it wasn't all tenants managing it, and the attempt has been to get these places, which were run by local authorities, local councils, and built them, to get them privatised, and it was a stage in order to try and do that. And so they're just simply not competent, George, to manage these. The people on the board of that housing tenant management organisation, they're not competent to employ the contractors. They don't know what they're doing.
They've done
a £10 million refurbishment contract that's ended up burning the whole place to the ground.
Golly. That's just the way it goes sometimes, doesn't it? Yeah, I was looking at the people coming out. There's all kinds of different people living there.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is really clear, the difference between Corbyn and May's visits today to the area. Theresa May arrives with no TV cameras or anything. She just goes and talks to some of the chiefs of the police and the ambulance, and then she's whisked off again. She wouldn't dare come out in public. She'd be lynched by the public around there. They're highly politicised. They've just booted out a Tory MP and brought in a Labour MP in that area of London. And she wouldn't last 5 seconds. She would really have everyone screaming at her. But Jeremy Corbyn, in contrast, was going around chatting with everybody and listening very carefully to what's going to happen. I mean, May wants a public inquiry into this. I don't think we need one. We just need these tower blocks properly managed. No fire alarms, George. Can you believe that?
Oh, massive, gosh.
Massive tower block with something like 500 people living in it. No fire alarm went off.
No smoke alarms?
No. Well, apparently in some of the individual blocks, there were, in individual people's flats, smoke alarms going off. But that doesn't help you. And, of course, the other problem was that people were told to stay inside. Now, they needed to get out because the whole block was going up in flames.
Oh,
burning,
my gosh.
From the outside in. That was the problem.
Golly.
And that was these blocks were never designed like that. I mean, there shouldn't be anything flammable on the outside of the building, but that was all just installed last year. Now that's left the whole place gutted.
Boy, that's tragedy.
It is, but lessons will be learnt, and it looks like probably something like they may finally announce around about 100 fatalities in that block of flats.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and it's unprecedented, really, in London. Another thing I heard was that the people managing the place had put big bollards in the way, so the fire engines couldn't actually get to the right place to put the fires out. Also, that the fire brigade didn't have these things which you can hold out, that people can jump out from higher up, you know, to land safely.
No, yes.
Well, apparently not, no.
My gosh.
But anyhow, you know, this is all still very much in the, people are examining what's
there
going on.
There was one story that a woman wrapped her baby up in a blanket and threw the baby out from 9 stories.
Well, that's quite feasible, yeah. You know, I just think that this is a part of London which is going to be very angry and will start fighting back immediately against an uncaring government. They were already angry. There were reports back in last November saying, by the tenants in this very same block, saying only a disastrous fire with a big loss of life is going to actually bring the attention onto these incompetent and evil landlords that they deserve, because they are already really angry. I mean, it's a super politicised area, George. They're very, very articulate. And there were threatening letters from the council's legal officers, Kensington Chelsea's council, demanding that they take some of their comments off the internet, this kind of thing. But they were not taken down.
Right. But so it's too bad.
Yeah, it's a sort of top-down management approach where you don't listen to anybody, and that is just simply no way to run things. You have a listening voice, and that's, I'm afraid, the way Britain's going. You know, top-down. The rich super elite just tell the underclass, the Untermensch, what they're going to do. They don't listen.
Oh, my gosh. It's terrible.
Yeah, I think you're getting a similar sort of thing over there, where you get basically people who are pliable put into power, you know, so that the elite can just manipulate them, get them to do whatever they want, you know. So you get people who are just not competent to do the job.
That's
quite clearly what we've seen in this Grenfell Tower. The towering inferno.
Wow, it's tragic. Well, look, Tony, I appreciate your update. And
okay, George. Yep.
And I really, really appreciate it. And we'll get back with you next week. How's that sound?
That sounds great, George.
Okay, Tony.
Hope to speak to you then.
Okay.
All the best.
Yes.
Bye.
Good night.